loose, and Maxey gets knocked down. Hart takes it away. Out top to DiVincenzo. His shot won't go. Hartenstein the rebound. Hartenstein gets it out to Ananobi. DiVincenzo a three. Bang! Bang! Knicks take a one-point lead.
Welcome back to the NBA Recap Show on the Mojo Sports Network. It's been a hell of a first week of the NBA playoffs, and we are just getting started. I'm your host, Alexander J. I've got with me Melbourne's Tom Dev, Perth's Yuri Bilcic. Julian Balthazar is joining us soon. He's stuck in traffic. He'll join us when he gets on. We're going to talk who has had the best series start, as every matchup has had two games except for the Celtics Heat in the East and the Thunder Pelicans in the West. They both play tomorrow, I believe. Then we're going to have a look at each of the playoff series so far and get to some other news, including the most improved award being awarded. Tom, how are you?
I'm good. And that was a really good introduction on the first go. You know, I quite enjoyed that. But, you know, look, I won't say to you, if you look at Jamal Murray, you missed the first 15 shots, but it's the one at the end that counts.
Yuri Bilcic, my man, how are you?
Yeah, great, Alex. And the whole playoff fever in full swing, right? And it's just been all too riveting once more. And hopefully this lines up to be one of the best postseasons yet. Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yuri's my favorite to start the show for not pointing out that this is the second attempt at starting today's show. But look, we'll get to the important stuff in a second. The last couple of weeks, we've been tracking our podcast ratings. So I have an update for you as we get started. If you're a returning listener, you'll know we were 41 in the Australian podcast charts a couple of weeks ago. Slid down to 75 last week. This week, it's bad news. 203 on the Australian basketball podcast chart. So we're going to need your help with some five-star reviews. Hell, I'll take a four-star review at this point in time. The good news, we did pop off internationally a little bit. We were on the Great Britain podcasting charts for sports. 154 for one single day. So a couple of you listeners from Great Britain, thank you very much. Lads, we'll start. We will wait for Jules to get through that notorious Melbourne traffic. And we can start with you, Tom. The Celtics Heat, one game only so far. I believe game two is tomorrow. Talk us through. Have they had the best series start?
Not at all. I mean, are we going straight to Celtics Heat, or are we just going best series start?
Look, first that's
start?
On me. I've started the show over twice. I'm not doing it a third time. We can talk about who had the best series start, and then we'll move on.
Look, if we're going to go best series start, I need to open up the show with an apology. I'm very sorry, Pascal Siakam. I slandered you for about 2 weeks straight. I'm not going to say I'm unfamiliar with your game, but definitely unfamiliar with this kind of Pascal Siakam, because, I mean, game one, 36 points, 13 rebounds. They did get absolutely slaughtered, though, so have that with a grain of salt. But then game two, he came back, 37 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists. He went, 60% or better in both games from the floor. And, you know, just a little nice stat for you, players to start the playoffs with back-to-back games of 35-plus points and 10-plus rebounds. Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, and now Pascal Siakam.
Oh, my God.
You're on a stat list with Wilt Chamberlain, you're doing something right. And, you know, I mean, Halliburton's been very passive. He hasn't really been that guy that we saw in November, December, especially in the in-season tournament. But Siakam, he's justified the trade. And let's just be realistic. He's adding a few extra numbers on that contract he's probably going to sign in the offseason with the Pacers.
Yeah, and you hope he's already agreed to that. Otherwise, the Pacers losing him is going to be disastrous for this squad. Yuri Bilcic, who has had the best series start for you?
Well, if I was to swing in the persuasion way that Tom said about Pascal Siakam, which was my first thought, I've got Damian Lillard too as my so far best player through two games. And of course, one reason why, Giannis Antetokounmpo is still out with that left calf injury. And his performance is right, especially that first half, game one, went off for 35 points. And poor old Andrew Nembhard was an absolute the cooker blender, right? There was one four-point play there. I think it was late in the first half where, yeah, unfortunately, Nembhard basically put his hands in the cookie jar where you're not supposed to, and Dame just let fly another one of those big cannon threes which he launched. I think it was his sixth and final three to the game. But his whole tone, right? Brook Lopez, those high pick-and-roll screens which have garnered so much success this season, and Dame was just killing the Pacers right there, and there was no rim pressure that Indiana were able to produce, especially Miles Turner forced to go up to guard Brook, because of course that pick and pop action which Dame can run with Brook on many occasions, but they were somehow to some degree able to curtail that in the second half today of game two, but looked as though early on game through, yeah, this game two happening today, that Dame and Brook had scored the first 19 points for the Bucks, and they were just absolutely killing them. And everyone knows about Dame's playoff resume in clutch moment situations and him getting hot and basically that whole basket looking like an ocean. And that's been a one real positive thus far, seeing Dame absolutely go off. And depending on when Giannis does come back from that calf injury, most likely midway through a series or maybe game five, well, that will probably decide for itself. But no, Dame's just been terrific thus far. And his whole shot selection, everyone knows that pull up from three, which unfortunately, if you're what Indiana did in game one, and you don't guard him early, then that ball's going to go through the hoop most of the time. And they were able to somehow go to work a little bit more. I think Coach Rick Carlisle did a really good job for the Pacers in terms of the X's and O's. And they could have easily have gone Aaron Nesmith on Damian Lillard. There's another, maybe a bigger body defender, because Nesmith's about 6'5", 6'6", but he stuck firm with his guns by basically remaining sort of true to Andrew Nembhard and keeping faith in him. And he basically paid it off right in that second half when it really sort of, the Pacers really lent in and started getting hot from the field.
Everybody, I'd like to give a warm round of applause and welcome Julian Balthazar, fresh out of traffic. Welcome back to the show, mate.
Thanks, guys. I don't know what it is. I think given that it's a public holiday tomorrow, I'm assuming that most people were cramming their work into tonight, and that's why there's a lot of traffic. So sorry for the delay, but great to be here and looking forward to discussing some NBA.
That's right. We're just talking about who has had the best series start so far. Do you've got an answer for us?
What's been said so far?
That's a really good point. Damian Lillard and Pascal Siakam.
Yeah, I would say Siakam as well. He's had two really, really good games. Keen to see how Shai Gilgeous-Alexander goes tomorrow, because he had a ripper first game as well.
Is it? I didn't ask you guys to prep. Tom, notorious hater. You've got a little bit of a hate in your genes. Is there somebody who's had the worst series start? I'll dip Devin Booker in there for your consideration. 19 points per game over two appearances, 25% from three on six attempts a game, shooting 38% from the floor, second in the series in turnovers. Tom, what say you? Do you have a better option for hater of the first week?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously everyone in New York's got Knicks fever at the moment, but it, you know, the 2-0 start has papered over the cracks, where Brunson has shot 29.1% from the field, 16.7% from three. If we'd had a healthy Joel Embiid, you have to question with those numbers for Brunson, would this be a 2-0 lead to the Knicks? But look, credit to other players like Josh Hart. He's definitely stepped up in his absence. But yeah, for the moment, Brunson, it's disappointing because I think ESPN or Bleacher Report had that poll of, like, you know, ranking all the players you'd want in the playoffs, and Brunson was number five. And after the first two games, I wouldn't even put him at 10 at this stage.
Alrighty, let's dive into the Eastern Conference, the recap of every series so far. We'll start with, Tom, your Celtics against the Miami Heat. Only one game so far, and the Celtics won by 20 points. It was 114-94. Jason Tatum had a 23-point triple-double. Bam Adebayo, 24 points for the Heat. Take it away, Tom.
Yeah, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly because they're a way more exciting series to talk about. But look, the Butler MCL injury, it changed everything. And it's unfortunate because I was kind of hoping that we'd get, you know, these two teams fully healthy and Celtics might actually beat their demons. But not, you know, Butler was brave in that play-in game against the Sixers. I didn't think he was that badly hurt if he could play, but he, that's incredible in my opinion. But look, I did get up at 3 a.m. for that game, and the Heat's game plan was basically just to hope that the Celtics would shoot themselves out of it. Celtics, you know, took 49 threes and they made 22. That was basically the game right there. The Celtics, they had even scoring across the board. I mean, six players had 10 or more points. Four players had 17 or more points. The Heat are going to make adjustments. Eric Spoelstra is probably the best coach in the league still. We saw that last year in the playoffs. But they will need more consistent offense. Rose is still out for game two. At this point, it's going to be hard to see the Heat stealing a game. But at the same time, there's only been one game. And really, with playoff series, it's kind of hard to get a grasp on everything until there's been two games played. Because for all we know, the Heat tomorrow morning steal a game, and this series completely changes. So that's all I've really got to say. I mean, I enjoyed, as much as being up at 3 a.m. isn't great, but I enjoyed watching that game, even when the lead did get down to 13 with about 2 minutes left. But other than that, that's about it.
The Jays, not Jason Tatum, not Jaylen Brown, Julian and Jiri. Anything else to say about that series?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, if you were to Miami Heat too, you almost have to pick your poison against the Celtics, right? And playing that can go the big ball, right, with Al Horford and Porzingis, which they did a few times during game one, but then also at small ball where they'll just completely stretch you out and nail down those threes, which for about the millionth time we've seen in the Boston Celtics in the last probably 3 seasons. In the postseason, have just absolutely annihilated teams from deep, and being a Bucks fan, know exactly how that feels in Game 7 of the 2022 Eastern Conference semifinals. So there's probably no real particular matchup that Miami can put on Jason Tatum. That's your concern if you're coach Eric Spoelstra. You can try Jaime Jaquez Jr., who's a pretty good defender on him, but then he's giving away 3 inches at best of size, and there's maybe even Hayward Highsmith. Two potentially, maybe if they do sort of alter the starting lineup, because Nikola Jovic has been starting, but he's not playing major 35, 40 minutes in one game. He's playing 15 to 20 at best. So there's a few options there that Miami do have, but they just beat you in various different ways. And that's the hardest part to contain. And unless Boston completely goes cold from deep, that's Miami's best hope, because the Heat, even though this season they shot the ball from three exceptionally well compared to last season, which I'm pretty sure they'll bottom right at 33%. That's what they've got somehow changed. And Bam Adebayo too. You saw with his number of field goal attempts in game one, I think he had about 18 field goal attempts, finished with 24 points and 9 rebounds out of the top of my head. He's probably going to have to at least take 25 shots. We know Bam isn't a high volume sort of field goal guy because he prefers to get his teammates involved. He's a very good passer, but they need him really badly in game two. That's all. And Terry Rozier, when he does get back from a neck injury, it's still probably a 50-50 for the time being. So a lot's going to have to ride behind Bam Adebayo's shoulders, and Tyler Herro too. Had a few sort of wonky shooting performances, especially in that playing tournament against Philadelphia. And he was better against Chicago, even though he shot around, I think it was only 42% from the game. But they also need his production too, especially from deep. Him and Duncan Robinson, they're the best two shooters for Miami from downtown.
Jules, anything on this series moving forward? I know you've only just popped on. I know it's only one game. Anything to note, or should we move on to the rock fight that is the Cavs and the Magic?
I'll just note, because the playoffs are an interesting time for us who love a little cheeky bet, and minutes go up, and Jason Tatum, I've noticed he in his last 21 out of 21 playoff games, he's had a minimum of 7+ rebounds. So for those, they just keep putting the value on that for some reason. But 21 out of 21 games, he's got 7+ rebounds. He's someone who just does not turn his back to the rim when there's a rebound to be grabbed. So keep that in mind. And also Jrue Holiday for 4+ assists has some good value. And he had only 3 against Miami Heat, but he had about 9 potential ones, some easy looks were missed. So I'll be adding him into my multi tomorrow. So Jrue Holiday, 4 assists, and Tatum, 7+ rebounds.
There is.
I don't know if Caleb Martin's going to keep rocketing underneath him when he's grabbing rebounds. I'm not sure if Tatum will get 7 anymore.
That's right. That's, of course, tunneling is not allowed, so.
There is one series I haven't seen a second of action from. It is the Rock Fight of the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Orlando Magic at the 4-5 spot. We knew this one was going to be ugly. We knew this one was going to be defensive heavy. And judging by the box scores, it's probably a good thing I haven't watched these games. Game one, 97 to 83 in favor of the Cavs. Game two, similar scorecard, 96 to 86 in favor of the Cavs. Jared Allen leads the series with 19 point rebounds per game for Cleveland. Paolo Banchero, 22 points. Doesn't look like they're getting a lot of bench scoring. Who has watched this series? What can you tell me? Nobody. I knew it. I knew it.
I just didn't want to admit it. I have watched it. It was very scrappy. And it wasn't so long ago we talked about how games have such high scores. And then, we finally see a game where it's just defense, defense. But the Cavs have definitely brought a lot of physicality. And I think most of us last week were predicting the Cavs from memory to win this series. And I've been a big fan of the Magic for the last few months. But what I said, where their downfall is that they've relied so heavily on their bench throughout the whole season. And now they're finding that they're basically starting Jonathan Isaac when he was one of their players who could ignite them off the bench. And Wendell Carter, obviously with a few injuries, he was only playing very limited minutes in game one. And then he came off the bench in game two. I expect him to start in game three. But, you know, one of the things that Magic, as we know, as Yuri says every time, the Magic don't rely much on three-pointers. So what they do is they rely on points in the paint. And when they try to go into the paint with Wagner and Banchero, they're met with Jared Allen and Evan Mobley. And Mobley's doing a fantastic job on Banchero at the moment. I think he's on one-on-one matchups. I think he kept him to 2 out of 11 from the field. And Banchero just could not get his game going. He was taking some ridiculously tough shots. So the Magic, they just don't have the pieces, I think, to come up against a team like the Cavs, where when Donovan Mitchell gets going, you have to put so much focus into him. But then you've got to worry about the Twin Towers and Mobley and Allen as well. And I just, yeah, I think with Suggs and Harris, they just don't have enough depth to sort of outscore the Cavaliers. They have to really rely on that defense, which has really been prominent in Magic in their home games. But away, on the road, they're just not strong enough. So I'm really keen to see how they go in game three, because they bring it home and that's where they have been strong. But they're going to have to work out something else, a different strategy to try and get in that paint or to get some scoring from the outside. Because Gary Harris is just not enough. I mean, he can pop one or two threes a game. It's just not enough. Banchero and Wagner need some support.
Yuri, go ahead.
Yeah, I think also too with Jalen Suggs, and this was a pretty scary moment, right, when he landed awkwardly on his knee, and you probably feared the worst in game two, and luckily it didn't amount to anything more serious, because that would just been almost a body blowing away for Orlando's perimeter defense, and he is their best perimeter defender, even though they have so many, and that, it again, it just will be an absolute catastrophe. But again, the three-point shooting, even though Franz Wagner hit a couple of threes in game two, and he shot below 30% this season, so they're probably not really that worried, the Cavs, in leaving him open. And just that's probably, we've already talked about it too, with Orlando's shooting from downtown, where it just completely deserts them. And it's just almost as though, how can they involve different schemes where they can draw Jared Allen out from the paint and force him on the perimeter and try and eliminate that shot blocking of the Cavaliers? Because we saw last season with the Knicks in the postseason, should I say, in the opening round, where the Knicks just completely, yeah, annihilated the Cavs, not just on the boards, but they're able to take either one of Mobley or Allen away from having their usual impact. And that's something Orlando, I think, has to get back to the drawing board. And they've only got, what, well, another 24 to 36 hours to really figure that out before the first home playoff match in, what, 5 years, since 2019 against the Toronto Raptors. So, no, it's interesting times ahead for them too. And I think you even spoke about it, Julian, before the series began, that do you think we'll see one game where both teams, or one team, scores over 100 points? I probably see most likely that no one's going to reach three figures.
It's been very physical, this series.
Tom,
yeah.
Do you want to touch on this series at all, or do you want to move on? Because I want to talk about the Indiana Pacers against the Milwaukee Bucks. I'll leave that up to you. You can take it which way.
Look, all I'll say is this series was like the rock bottom of the playoffs, and just it was completely highlighted yesterday by two all-time great playoff games going on while this game was going on, and no one even shed light on it. I mean, TNT, when they were running through the Lakers-Nuggets game and the Knicks-Philly game, we're like, oh, yeah, there was actually a third game on today. We might have forgotten. So, let's move on as fast as we can.
All right, I will. The two-game series between the Milwaukee Bucks so far without Giannis Antetokounmpo and the Indiana Pacers is one apiece after a very good win today for Indiana in Milwaukee. Game one, 109-94 in the Bucks' favor. Then game two, 108-125 to the Pacers. Damian Lillard in this series, Yuri, you'll tell us in a second, has been going nuclear early, bearing the scoring load, scoring like 30 points across, like averaging 30 in the first half of both these games. We spoke about Pascal Siakam's emergence as well. Yuri, you're our Bucks man. You take us through this series.
It definitely has been a nuclear start from Damian Lillard, Alex, and everything that the Bucks needed with Giannis being out. And it's just those plays, right, where he's been able to get free downhill, attack the paint, pull up from three. And we spoke earlier about Indiana's defensive assignments going astray for that time, especially in that first half of game one and early on in game two. And they were able to rectify that in the second half. And that started from game one with the double teams, traps, full court press, and trying to take the ball out of Dame's hands. And we saw, right, with Chris Middleton stepping up in that second half of game one with 15 of his 23 points. I think he only had 1 3-point attempt for the whole game, which is unusual for Chris, too. He normally takes four, five, six, 3-point attempts a game. So he settled a lot in his passing the mid-range, which he nailed most of them anyway. And also Pat Bev's defense on Tyrese Haliburton. And the reason why Haliburton only took 7 field goal attempts in game one in 38 minutes was Milwaukee's double team pressure. They tried doing the same thing today, but we saw many just ridiculous passes from Haliburton out of the double teams. And well, he finished with 12 assists today, and just his whole floor vision, you can't really scout too much. You can absolutely throw everything at him to try and take the ball out of his hands and make either Aaron Nesmith or Andre Nembhard or Pascal Siakam a passer. But Siakam's a very good facilitator. So, again, you almost play peril in that way too, because they have two very good passers, and Miles Turner's not a bad passer himself. So, yeah, it's just we saw that in terms of just the whole tenacious defense, right, in game one, when they were just completely dog-hungry, committed at all times, and basically didn't really miss out too many assignments and didn't allow Indiana to play that full V8 supercar way. So I wrote in one of my articles, transition offense, and that was something that they got completely stuffed in game one, but not game two today. There were just too many breakdowns from the Bucks, and that's full credit to the Pacers. That's the way they've played right this season under Coach Rick Carlisle. They want to move the ball up fast. They want to get shots up with essentially 15, 16 seconds left on the shot clock and force you to play at their pace. And unfortunately, the Bucks weren't able to adjust that. And there were numerous times today where the Bucks closed within 4 3-point points, and Indiana went on those big runs. And especially, I think, 9 minutes left in the game there too, where the Pacers just completely blew Milwaukee out of the water, and the margin got
13-0
run
with
20 points.
Yeah, yep. Just really fun as hell game to watch. Watched on my lunch break, and the lunch break turned into a 2-hour lunch break because I couldn't put this one down. It was a 1-point game in the third quarter. Indiana threatened with a couple 10-point leads. But yeah, just the scoring, the turnovers forcing them. Very, very fun game. Jules and Tom, did you happen to watch today?
I don't know if you guys had this issue this morning either. I think the whole world did. I mean, once League Pass actually started working today, I did manage to flick onto it. I don't know. Maybe it's just me going off reputation. I still feel like the Bucks are going to get over the line in this series. I mean, the game one was dominant. When I eventually woke up after that early morning start for the Celtics, I watched the second half, and the Bucks were dominant. I mean, yes, Lillard didn't score in the second half, but he was just making shot after shot after shot, which we've seen him do throughout his career. If Giannis was in here, I generally reckon it'd be a sweep. But my question is, I mean, if the Bucks do go down 2-1 at that next game in Indiana, do you bring back Giannis, assuming he's somewhere around the 80% mark? Because, you know, we don't want to see him go in there and end up doing more damage. We know that Achilles error, like we saw with Durant, it can be very sensitive with these calf injuries. And also, we'll touch on this in the Knicks series, but we are seeing a superstar in Philly side going through an injury, and it's not too pretty. So I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested in Yuri's opinion, whether he thinks Giannis should rush back if they were to go down 2-1.
Oh, it's definitely, yeah, it's sort of an unknown, isn't it, Tom? And one that, it's sort of up to the Bucks medical staff to really assess how Giannis's calf is. And that's probably, again, that whole concern, right, with Achilles injuries and what we've seen. And too many players have done their Achilles over the years. And Wes Matthews is one player who did his Achilles. And Kobe Bryant, remember, late in the Lakers season 2012-13, where he carried the team, and Mike D'Antoni was ramping up his minutes to 40, 45 minutes just to get the Lakers in the playoffs, and he busted his Achilles against Golden State. But hopefully, I just can't really get too much of a predicament on when Giannis will return. Maybe it's midway through his series. Maybe it's not. But hopefully, again, what we've seen with Dame, and if Chris can just be himself, and we saw that in game one, and if we can get more of a contribution from Brook as well, because that's the one thing I see too, just with Brook Lopez. And we saw, yeah, he hit 3 of his first 4 3-pointers today, but try and play more low post. I just keep stressing about this a lot with Brook, because everyone knows what in 2013, 2014, him and DeMarcus Cousins were arguably two of the league's best young low post guys on the block. You can just throw it down to him and he'll go to work, and just hopefully they do a little bit more of that, even though Bobby's the main guy for doing it. But yeah, I'd just like to see a little bit more schematic changes, I think, where Brook Lopez is incorporated at various points, because don't want to see him sort of hanging out on the perimeter too much, and we really need his rebounding too. That's the one thing with Giannis, where he grabs 13, 14, 15 rebounds a game, and that's where so much of the pressure lies on Brook to grab his fair amount of rebounds, even though he's never been regarded as an elite rebounder, even at 7 feet. So if I was probably assessing if to bring Giannis back, I'd probably wait to see what happens after game three before pulling the trigger.
Doc Rivers did say to media that Giannis was shooting on the floor today. So take out of that what you will. Jules, any last thoughts on this series?
That's probably why Middleton's got a bit of value. But in this last 14 out of 14 games without Giannis, where he's played over 30 minutes, he's hit 15 or more points. So for those looking for a bet with a bit of value, $1.40 for Middleton to get 15 points. He's done that in his last 14 out of 14 without Giannis. So if he's out for game three, I'd be looking at that one.
And for my Bucks fans out there, Yuri, you can't get Bucks in six unless you win. Unless you lose two games. I butchered that. That was going to be so smooth. Quickly, on to what has been my favorite series so far, the last one in the East. It's the New York Knicks taking on the Sixers from Philadelphia. It is, would you believe, 2-0 to the Knicks, 111 to 104 the first game. And then you heard at the top of the show, we might as well play it again here, 104 to 101, the Knicks winning at the end of the game over the Sixers, down by five with like 13 seconds remaining. I don't know who we had in the dock to take over this series. This has been fun as hell. Game two, Josh Hart plays all 48 minutes. Tyrese Maxey's balling out. He averages 34 for the series. Joel Embiid looks like he's in pain when he's on the floor. Who wants to take it from me? Because this is, there's so much to talk about with this matchup.
I don't think I'll be able to do it justice because it's been such a good series, but I'll chime in with a few notes that I made watching game two. I didn't get a chance to watch game one, but I've watched game two, and Tom mentioned before that Brunson started a bit slow. He's actually the first player since 1976 playoffs to shoot less than 30% with at least 50 attempts. So that's a 50-year record that he's just secured there, but there's no doubt he's going to get going at some point. But someone else has stepped up, which is Josh Hart, who has been, and a lot of people have been criticizing Tibbs for the amount of minutes he puts into his players in the regular seasons, but they're used to this now. And, you know, he's so used to playing 40-plus minutes and getting 10-plus rebounds. He had 13 rebounds and 15 rebounds in the first few games, which was pretty predictable. But what we didn't predict was that he'd have 21 and 22 points, so with four threes in each of the games. So now he's sort of offering an offensive element to the game that probably surprises the Sixers as well. But where do you touch on this? I think with Tibbs, he's done a good job now with Robinson back in the side. I think Yuri was talking about Robinson last week, but now, you know, he's got that up his sleeve. So the first game, Hardenstein was a bit quiet. So they got Robinson in. He had four blocks in game one. They played him 30-plus minutes. In game two, Robinson didn't have as much of an impact. So they finished with Hardenstein, and he got what you might label as the game-winning block as well. And I think where it falls apart for the Sixers is obviously one is Embiid. He's still incredible at 75% or 80% fitness, but every time this guy jumps, you're worried for him. Like, he looks like he's legitimately playing on one leg. And with the sort of role he played, he's not just out there on the wing. He's getting in there with Hardenstein and Josh Hart flying in for the rebounds. It looks like it's just a second away from being injured for the whole series. So we really worry about him. But then Kyle Lowry, for me, he's been a point guard his whole life. But if they want to run the play through Maxey and Embiid, does that make Kyle Lowry a shooting guard? Because I just don't think he fits well into that category. And I think, you know, you can talk about Nick Nurse and the timeout. I don't know if everyone saw, obviously everyone here saw, but for the listeners out there that didn't see, you know, the Philadelphia 76ers were down by 3 points or so or 2 points with about 10 seconds or so left. And they didn't call a timeout. They decided to inbound the ball, and Tyrese Maxey was potentially fouled, is what they're trying to say. And Nick Nurse is trying to claim that the ref didn't see his timeout. But really, if you look at it, okay, the timeout wasn't seen. Firstly, they should have called it in the first place to advance the ball and not take any chances. But secondly, the shot from DiVincenzo actually missed, and no one crashed the offensive board. And then he got another chance, and they let him score that one. So I think, yeah, there was a few mistakes they made in that last few, that last minute that they'd probably want to have back. And those sort of losses are really, really deflating when you feel like you've been the better side all game and it gets stolen away from you. But Embiid in his press conference or in his post-game interview said that they're the better team and they're going to win this series. So if you choose to believe a 75% healthy Embiid, then that's on you.
Tom, I can feel you bubbling with hate. Give it to
us. Yeah, I won't lie. When that DiVincenzo 3 went in, instead of a shocked reaction, I just laughed. I won't lie. I've been there. You know, the Celtics have blown more games than anyone over the last 3 years. And, you know, after game five against Milwaukee in 2022, I went to some dark places because we had that one wrapped up. I think that should be an example, though, for the Sixers. I mean, we blew that game and we went down 3-2 going to Milwaukee, and our franchise player stood up and scored 46 points, and then we ended up winning the series. Even last year, you go to that Heat-Celtics game, how easy would it have been for Miami to put their heads down, basically just phone it in that game seven, because they were, what, 2 seconds away from going to the finals. All of a sudden, Derek White gets that put back. But they didn't. They went out. So this is the Sixers' time to go out. But no, they do what Philadelphia and what Daryl Morey always do, and they're going to go file grievances with the league. Like, for my Seinfeld fans, what do they think this is? Festivus with the airing of grievances? Like, no, just like, you have to just suck it up. Like, I'm sorry. They did this after game six against the Celtics last year. And I can give you, or Jason Tatum can give you 51 reasons why that didn't work out for them. Just, they have to. I'm sorry. And Nick Nurse is the one who's just always complaining in his press conferences. There was an article that someone retweeted today where it was Joel Embiid complaining about Nick Nurse complaining too much back in the 2022 playoffs. Look, I'm sorry. They went down 2-0. It was poor execution from Lowry. Like Julian said, they should have called a timeout. Lowry quickly grabbed the ball thinking he was going to pull a fast one on the Knicks team. They were switched on. Yes, the NBA last minute report said that Maxey was fouled, but you know what? The moment that there like no open men appeared for Lowry to inbound to, quick timeout. And, you know, I feel for Embiid. When he did that self alley-oop to himself in game one and went down with the knee, I was really worried for him. I am worried for his future health and what he's going to be like post his career, the way he's playing. And, I mean, yes, he scored 34, but, like, I look more stable walking in the house at 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning than he does going up and down the court. Like... if you watch him, he's just lumbering up and down. And it's just, I don't know. And my question to you guys is, if the 76ers were to go 3-0 down, do you continue to play Embiid? Like, do you continue to risk what might be a whole season next year?
You just get the feeling he's a very stubborn and very driven man. So he'd never sit himself out. But yeah, look, it's a great question, Tom. It's a great question. Yuri, wrap this season up, series up for us.
Well, you can make a case this series should be one apiece, to be honest. And we saw Josh Hart have that big clutch three. I'm pretty sure it was in the last 2 minutes in game one. And the Sixers, I think he even spoke about it post-game two, that they were leaving him wide open. They just weren't guarding him. And he capitalized on that opportunity to see at least the spot of green light there and hit most of his three-point shots, which he was struggling from the field at that time before he did make that big one which mattered the most. And even right at game two today and his production once more and so much being sort of applied on Jalen Brunson's shoulders. And I think that was always probably a thing though for Knicks going into the series, was how much more production would they be able to get from Brunson, because it was pretty clear that he was going to give them 30 plus points. But it was the other guys there too, like OG Anunoby, even Dante DiVincenzo with his big three, right? And just speaking on that play too, Alex, that rebound from Isaiah Hartenstein, that big offensive rebound to set up DiVincenzo, who missed his initial three, right, from exactly that same spot, and then to let it fly with the same amount of confidence, not being undaunted by what happened a few seconds earlier, that just took absolute ice cool precision to nail that, because I think most players probably will shied away from that situation alone, and he didn't. And he's their best three-point shooter too, Dante DiVincenzo, apart from Jalen Brunson. And that's where I think probably for the rest of the series and what Philly does do in terms of this whole Brunson assignment and doing a pretty stellar job on him today through the opening two games, is a lot of pressure then goes onto an OG Anunoby and also to Isaiah Hartenstein and even Miles McBride, right? And he was drained in Nick's chants, right? They were chanting his name, and even just those unsung heroes in the Knicks lineup who've absolutely set the world alight when not many expect them to, if you're outside, of course, being a non-Knicks fan. But he absolutely delivered, and that's I think the true beauty about this team, and probably from minus Julius Randle, of course, is that it's almost just a roster that Tibbs, of course, has had over the years, where it's basically full of pit bulls in a way, that they just fight and scrap and they don't really relent until that final buzzer goes. And that's pretty much what defined them once more in game two, when you're down six with 30 seconds left. And again, it was just almost like this whole Reggie Miller moment and whole Tracy McGrady moment just in one. Just it was more of a collective team effort to get through.
We'll be back with the Western Conference recap after this break. Tom, take it away.
Well, I mean, we've taken 40-odd minutes just to get through the boring series. If you're not going to come back to listen to the exciting ones, then I don't know what you're doing, but let's head to the break.
All right, that was the break. This is Back to Us, the Western Conference. We're going to touch very briefly on the 1-8 matchup. It was a hell of a game, but there's only been one game between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the New Orleans Pelicans. It was 94-92, a rock fight as well at the end of this game. The Thunder going ahead with an SGA jumper. Chet Holmgren got sent to the line and made one, missed one, meaning that CJ McCollum had a chance to win it at a three at the buzzer. It did not fall. Jiří Bilsič, how have you found this series, albeit briefly?
Yeah, I did watch game one, Alex, and it was everything that was, it lived up to the hype, the 1-8 matchup. And I wrote about this in one of my other game one talking points on the Thunder and Pelicans today, that New Orleans don't really represent your number eight seed. And it may sound outlandish to say that, but a team that won 49 games and has plenty of depth, not just a very good starting five, but also a very reliable bench. And they pushed the Thunder a long way. And that's the one thing, if you're Coach Willie Green going into game two tomorrow, that you should take credit for. And the rebounding count, I think this is one thing, Alex, and something else I did mention in the piece, is their advantage on the glass. When you take away Chet Holmgren, who else do the Thunder have as that big guy to go up against Larry Nance Jr. or Jonas Valanciunas to take them away from the boards? Because JV completely annihilated the Pelicans on the back, should I say Thunder on the backboards. He had 20 rebounds, nine of those offensive, and he always seems to play exceptionally well against OKC for over the years. And I think especially since he was traded to Memphis, he's had a few mammoth games. He had a 25.15 rebound game. He had a 22.12 rebound game, and that both occurred in 2021. And there was another, I think, 39-point performance he had in one of those two. So he always seems to feast on the Thunder. And that's the big thing if you are OKC, is how do you take him away from the glass? Because the Pelicans had 18 offensive rebounds as a whole and won the offense and won the rebounding count by plus eight. But I think where the Thunder had their most success too, Alex, and they did this right throughout the game, was putting CJ McCollum on switches against SGA. And that's to the Thunder's benefit, because McCollum is a sort of average defender, and they saw that opportunity to set those high screen and rolls and take Herb Jones away from SGA. Because every time Herb was on Gilgeous Alexander, he was having the most success. He was able to deny Gilgeous Alexander those drives to the basket. He was forcing him to stop on the pivot and pass the ball back out to the perimeter. And when you eliminate that and have either Brandon Ingram, who's a solid defender, but not to the fullest extent of Herb Jones or CJ McCollum or Naji Marshall, then that's where OKC's had their advantage, well, has had an advantage, I'd say, throughout. And, well, game one only being a very small sample size, and that's what mattered most. And then, of course, we saw the last couple of minutes were pretty frantic, right? I think the Pelicans had three offensive rebound opportunities, right? There was one missed three to CJ McCollum. There was a missed left corner three to Herb Jones. And then Brandon Ingram took a contested right wing three, which he completely clanked. And those opportunities there inside the final 2 minutes, which unfortunately went awry for the Pelicans. You saw ones that you look, do you take that three, especially from Ingram? Do you settle to his mid-range spot, which he nailed, well, not most of the time on the night because he was only 5 of 17, but just those type of shot selections there, which he may have decided to take a better shot than just your first instinct, which Ingram did take, of course. And then it went down to that final 30 seconds there where McCollum, unfortunately, was matched up again for about the 50 millionth time on SGA, and he hit that incredibly ridiculous leaning jumper, right, for the three-point play. And it went down to that final possession. Kayson Wallace came on, the rookie, and did an absolute marvelous job on CJ. He denied him first. CJ had that sort of initial fumble, had to collect it, and lost essentially 2 seconds. There was only about 4 seconds, I think, left in the game, and Kayson was stuck onto him like super glue. And then eventually CJ was able to get by him, but then had to take that absurdly ridiculous leaning three-pointer, which clanked in the back of the rim. And It was just an absolutely marvelous game to watch, Alex. And the whole defense right throughout the first quarter, both teams only scored 17 points. And it was just a battle of attrition, right, where both teams didn't relent one bit and every possession was an absolute dogfight. And I think this is what this series is going to be. And I think the whole context of this matchup is going to be extremely close. And I think one that's going to go to seven games eventually.
Julian, Tom, I hope you didn't prepare anything for that series because Yuri just nailed everything. We're going to move on to the Clippers and Mavs. There is nothing left to say about that. Two games in the Clippers and Mavs series, split one apiece. Game one, 109 in the Clippers' favor over the Mavs at 97. And then today, the Mavs getting it by 96-93. Luka Doncic averages almost 33 points across the two games. Kawhi Leonard returned today for the Clippers after missing 25 days with what they were calling that knee inflammation. I think he had 15 points. I should have double-checked that. Tom, take it away.
Well, in a series that's full of stars like Kawhi, Luka, Kyrie, Harden, Paul George, I'm going to open up by talking about Ivanka Zubac. I generally believe he might be... Yeah, baby Laker. I mean, when you trade him across the hallway to the other locker room, I don't know how much of a Laker he can still call himself. But look,
I miss him much.
That was one of the most puzzling traits when they got rid of him. Like, I still don't really understand
You're preaching to the choir, man. All right, quickly move on. I'm getting distracted.
But look, the Mavs have really struggled with his size. I mean,
they traded him for nothing. I'm going to look up what they traded him for. It was like a second rounder. I'm going to come back to this. Go ahead.
So in game one, he had 20 and 15 and was a plus 15. Game two today, he was 13 and 12, but he was a plus four and a 3-point loss. I mean, Maxi Kleber is getting game time because of it, and he did hit a clutch three today. But other than that, Maxi Kleber hasn't really been that valuable of an asset to the Mavs recently. I think he could generally be an X factor. And if him and Harden are going to keep spamming the pick and roll, I think the Mavs might genuinely struggle with it. But you know what? Game one, I didn't watch it live, but from what I've heard, from what I've read, from what I've seen, Mavs really just didn't show up until the second half. And by then it was a foregone conclusion. But if you do look at the box score, I mean, Luka in game one, he still had 31, 13 and 6. Game two today had 32, 6 and 9. Hit a huge three down the stretch where he basically just ran down the sideline screaming at the crowd when the Clippers called timeout. I mean, surprisingly, 42.3% from the field in both games. And look, the reality is this Mavs team might be able to make a conference final on the back of Luka, but if they're going to keep winning and they're going to make the finals, they need the others to step up. I mean, in game one, that loss, Luka and Kyrie, they combined for 64 points, 10 assists, 20 rebounds. The rest of the team, there was eight players that played meaningful minutes. They combined for 33 points, 4 assists, 21 rebounds. So essentially, they got one more rebound than the Luka Kyrie duo and every other category they were outscored in. So if they're going to do anything, they need to step up. They need to start playing their role a bit better. And then today, Kawhi, again, another injury-laden start. He just didn't look great. He had some moments, but he just looked slow. He looked lethargic, and he was just going through the motions. I expect him to be better as time goes, but at the same time, every time we've seen him in the postseason and he ramps it up, he just ends up getting injured again. So is he really going to be much better coming in the series with an injury? I don't know. From what I saw today, I feel like the Mavs have still got this one just purely because you don't know what you're going to get from those Clippers stars on a day-to-day basis. I mean, full credit to James Harden. He was great in game one. Today, he had some moments, but you could just kind of tell that down the stretch, Mavs knew what they were going to do, whereas the Clippers were very much your turn, my turn, drive in, take some awful shots. So I think Luka's just going to keep doing what he's doing and they'll probably squeak this one out in maybe six or seven.
Jules, I'd like to hear your thoughts before I open up some old wounds.
The old wounds, I'm looking forward to that. Tom summed up pretty well. I watched the whole game today, but I didn't really note anything down, to be honest. I thought as well, similar to Tom, that the Clippers offense was really stagnant and it felt like they didn't really have any passing or anything going. I think the first game they only had, 14? Oh, that was the Clippers. That was the Mavericks. Only had 14 assists. The Clippers had 21, but majority of them were to Harden. And I think for the Mavs, as Tom said, they need a bit of help. I thought PJ Washington was probably that help today in some respect. I mean, obviously he only scored, 16 or 18 points, but he scored some really crucial threes from the wing. And yeah, I don't know. I think I need to see a bit more with Kawhi in the side before I make a judgment on how this series is going to go, because I don't think we've seen enough yet. But from today, what I saw, I just really have no idea how this one's going to pan out, to be honest.
Okay, here it is. Look, the Los Angeles Lakers, traded away Ivica Zubac and Mike Beasley for Mike Muscala. This is 2019, all right? This is the third year of Ivica Zubac. He's on his rookie scale, backup center. Can you imagine if the Lakers had a backup center behind AD in Zubac? Zubac still only makes $10 million a year. He is good. That's great value. The Lakers could have had him. It's not like we used Mike Muscala the next year in the championship run. We let him walk as a free agent, all right? Mike Muscala is not that good to start with, but this is what happens. I get upset about a team I don't even support anymore. I'm just saying it was indefensible at the time. I miss Ivica Zubac. Fuck me. The Buss family who owns the Lakers, man, they make some questionable decisions. It works out. They won the title that year. We shouldn't get too worked up about it. I haven't even moved on and got ready for the next series. We were going to look at the Wolves and the Suns. It's a two-game series to the Wolves and Edwards. Bit of an up-and-down series, if we're being honest. Game one, I'm just loading up that score ahead of me. 120-95, it was a blowout over the Suns for the Wolves. And then a bit closer, 105-93 in game two. Yuri, talk to us about the Wolves.
Yeah, did watch game two today, Alex, and that was just another far clinical defensive whole team effort once more. Hold the Suns under 100 points, 93 today, 95 in game one, and Jaden McDaniels was the big story in this game, right?
He was, yeah. Where, yeah.
Of course, Anthony Edwards was struggling from the field, even though he got to the free throw line on many counts. But yeah, Jaden's the one we've talked about him on a few episodes on the show, that his defense, right, his versatility is so paramount to what the Timberwolves have become the league's best defense, and him guarding Devin Booker and just completely smothering him down, or guarding on KD, even though KD had a couple of leaning fadeaway jumpers over him today, which went through, and also Bradley Beal at different points throughout the game. But his just in your face in a way, not in your face in terms of taunting you, but in your face and just staying with you 94 feet. It's one that you can't teach defenders. I think the specialist ones, the great ones, know exactly how to do it without giving away cheap fouls. And he just absolutely completely locked down on Devin Booker and the Suns as a whole. I think we saw probably that first half where their offense looked really good, the Suns. I think it was 47-40, about 4 minutes left, and they were getting in a really good flow there with KD, of course, was hitting his shots. Bill had sort of a bit of an off night here and there too, and Eric Gordon early on, he hit some good threes too to really give them an extra ignition of offense, especially when Grayson Allen. Well, this is also another thing too, before I go back, is that Grayson Allen rolled his ankle trying to contest Mike Conley's layup, and he was a game-time decision heading into today's game two, and what his status is for game three remains unknown because he didn't look too great. He had to be helped by a Suns trainer back down into the locker room. So
they're calling it day-to-day at the moment, which isn't awful, but it's still not great.
So keep tabs on that too, because Grayson shot 46.1% from downtown and led the league for three-point shooting, but yeah, and then afterwards, that too, the whole Wolves offense just completely got clicking, right? That probably from that five-minute patch in the last quarter where it just completely blew the game open. It was 93-78, and there was just too many breakdowns. I think there was one brilliant play Mike Conley ran with Rudy Gobert, which those two have nailed since their days at the Utah Jazz, where Yusuf Nurkic basically came up to hedge, and then Gobert just rolled to the rim, and Mike Conley gave him a bounce pass, and he just flushed it with no one helping weak side to rotate, whether that was Durant, who was basically the closest guy to the rim, and he just didn't even catch sight of Gobert. And I think that's what pretty much just really typified Minnesota's whole surge from there. And I think Frank Vogel, and there was definitely two plays as well where he was all right with the officiating, where he thought that the Suns should have got a couple of foul calls their way, and that eventually manifested itself into him getting a technical, I think, with about 8 minutes left with the Suns down 14. And just unfortunately, there was no way out there for Phoenix. And this is probably, again, a really big litmus test for them right now, especially that opportunity they had, right, Alex, and at the second quarter where Karl Anthony Towns picked up his third foul late in the first, and Coach Chris Finch, yes, he did take a gamble. Of course, we get it. But then afterwards, you somehow have to use your smaller size to your advantage in a way too. Even though Naz Reid and Rudy Gobert have enjoyed their success, you've somehow just got to try and exploit it with Durant and also Bill and Booker and try and get them better shots in the way too, which, yeah, they probably didn't get to its fullest extent. So that's probably one if you look and you say, well, if Gobert's in foul trouble in game three or if Towns's in foul trouble in game three, then we've got to exploit as much as possible and try and build a lead, and especially at home.
All right, Tom, Julian, you're going to tag team on our last series, the Denver Nuggets, the defending champions, against the most famous team in basketball. Sorry, Tom, the Los Angeles Lakers. Jules, start us off.
Yeah, well, I watched game two, and I tell you what, if there was any more indication that you're not going to win a series, it's when your 39-year-old hits 26 points, 12 assists, two big blocks. Your point guard, who's under the fire, hits seven threes. Your center goes 11 for 12 from the field in the first half, and you still lose the game. I mean, the poor Lakers, they threw everything at the Nuggets, and they still couldn't come away with the victory. And they got off to one of the best halves we've seen. I've seen them play. They kept the Nuggets to 44 points. They had good defense. They had a good strategy in place between D'Lo and Davis. They had this sort of high pick and roll where they got a switch where Jokic was kind of a bit out of place, and it gave Anthony Davis these clear shots, and they kept running that play. And they also had another one where they would hand off the ball to LeBron, and then Gordon, who was on him, would have to switch. And again, they'd find space for AD, and they came in with some good strategy, and they were playing really well. And there was a moment I noted that I was watching where D'Lo had Peyton Watson on his hip, and then he just brushed straight past him, so Jokic had to come over to help. They got the ball to Anthony Davis. D'Lo had six assists in this game, and they were just exploiting that, and they made it look really, really easy. And, you know, the Nuggets were just dropping their heads at how many shots Anthony Davis was making. It was just making it seem easy. But what was probably genius coaching in the second half was the switches that they made. Well, KCP went on to LeBron in the second half, and it forced, and it also, they also put Aaron Gordon onto Anthony Davis instead of LeBron. So what happened was they stopped the switch, and basically Davis was just out on the 3-point line. He basically didn't get that switch anymore. So they were forcing LeBron into these isolation plays where KCP would just keep running over the screen. So the Lakers went a bit cold. But for an offensive point of view, I think one player who just always goes underrated, and he's very, very hot and cold, is Michael Porter Jr. I mean, to hit 6 out of 10 threes, he's that person who sort of bailed them out when they looked like they were gone. And the Nuggets are probably the best team in the whole league at being able to chop a lead when it's high. I mean, LeBron himself in his post-interview said that a 20-point lead isn't safe in this league. And I think the Nuggets are probably the best team at reducing a lead. And Porter is probably one of the main reasons for that. I mean, he hits some clutch threes and some bailout threes, which is basically where the offense goes cold and you're looking for one player to just chuck something up. I mean, Trey Murphy does that really well for the Pelicans. And I think Porter did it really well for the Nuggets, and he hit that crucial three in the last few minutes as well. So I think, yeah, the Lakers having thrown everything at this game and did not come away with the win, it's just so deflated. I'd wonder whether they can get one or two back at home. But for me, like, the fact that they lost that game, for me, reiterates that they have no chance of winning this series.
Tom, I watched both of these games, and game two was really eye-opening. The second half in particular, like, AD just started to get cooked by Nikola Jokic. And maybe it's just as simple as no one on earth can stop him. Maybe he's just the best basketball player of the last 5 to 6 years. It was also really curious, like, if you watch the game back, some of the Lakers' rotations they're puzzling. So, like, Nikola Jokic will be doubled by two men. Rui Hachimura is guarding the man at the top of the arc, but takes steps back as if he's, like, preparing for a drive from Nikola Jokic. Jokic just hits what is a wide up, excuse me, not Jokic. It ends up being Michael Porter Jr. at the top of the arc. Hits a wide open three because there's no man on him. There's been some puzzling, and I've seen reactions to it online as well, some puzzling, like, coaching decisions. I don't even know if they're decisions or if it's, like, a lack of, I don't know, maybe the Lakers are in two minds about what coverage they've got going. It's been fun to watch from a matchup and a coaching standpoint, but Tom, I'd be very interested to see how you see this series, given you might be the biggest Laker hater I know. Let's be quite honest.
Look, I think Bill Simmons would probably take that from me.
Yeah, but I'm not connected with him. I'm a well-connected man. I'm not that well-connected.
Look, it was like Christmas for me yesterday. I watched the 76ers just absolutely piss away a game. And then the next minute, the Lakers got a 20-point lead. All their fans are going off on Twitter like, we aren't scared of the Nuggets. We've just got home court advantage back. Next minute, you know, it all goes down the drain and Murray hits that shot and they're very quiet on Twitter all of a sudden.
They're getting beat by Gru.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, if you want to know, just like, I think basketball might be a side hobby for Jokic. It's like, we joke about basketball being a side hobby for Butler, but the difference is Jokic is, like, the best player in the world.
I'm really jealous of this Nuggets team because I've seen my Celtics team just falter in the clutch. Whereas the Nuggets are the opposite. They're the anti-Celtics in the clutch. They always score. I don't understand how you can beat them in a clutch situation because you think that you're going to stop them. Even yesterday, Jokic takes that horrible three because he thinks he's going to get fouled, goes over to the middle of nowhere, and yet somehow Gordon is just there. He's just perfect position, grabs it, throws it out to Michael Porter Jr. Instead of pulling it out and setting the offense, he just chucks up a three, and you're like, what is he doing? Go straight in, tie game. This Nuggets team, it's like an orchestra, and it's just all on note. It's all going smoothly no matter what. Even when they're down 20, they're like, oh, yeah. It's like, we'll just give you a head start. We know what we're going to do. We're going to win this anyway. I don't see how the Lakers can beat the Nuggets. Like Julian pointed it out, those, you know, Davis, LeBron, Russell had great games. Like the Reeves and Hachimuras of the world didn't. But when those three are on song, you kind of think that, you know, Lakers should win. They didn't. And Jokic is just incredible. I just, when you think he can't get better, 27, 20, and 10. And he wasn't even trying. Like, give that man just the MVP already. I mean, I'm tempted to just give him the finals MVP already. I don't see how this Nuggets team gets beaten in a 7-game series. I mean, Vanderbilt and Wood could be back for game three. Great.
Wood.
Two more Lakers who
are
going
to get. Right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is great. Two more Lakers who are going to get their asses kicked in. I just think these Nuggets, they're on the way to maybe a sweep. Maybe the referees will throw on a sweetener and the Lakers will get one game. But I don't. That's 10 in a row. May as well be 12 at this stage.
You know who'd be really handy on the Los Angeles Lakers is Ivica Zubac, like a seasoned 7-year veteran, just to play some back out minutes to throw some fouls at Jokic.
Or Mike Muscala, you know. Oh.
All right, now you're taking it too far. All right, that's our season. I keep saying season. Those are our series reviews. We've got some other news to get through while we run out of time. So just briefly, we touched on Grayson Allen being day-to-day with that ankle injury for the Suns. News coming out this week, I can't believe it, JJ Redick is to interview with the Hornets for the head coach position. Just goes to show, if you have five solid podcasts in a row, the Hornets will interview anybody. So here's hoping this is a classic so I can get a gig. The Spurs reportedly don't see Trae Young as a fit next season next to Victor Wembanyama. And the most improved award goes to Philadelphia's Tyrese Maxey. This season, I'm getting the two words mixed up. It's time to end today's show. Kobe White came second. He was my pick. Alperen Şengün, my preseason pick at three. We had some good players. Jalen Williams at four. Jalen Brunson at five for the most improved. Danny Avdija from Washington snuck in. Cam Thomas, Jalen Suggs, Tyrese Haliburton, and Grayson Allen rounded out the top 10. Yuri, pick one of those. We've got JJ Redick, we've got the Spurs, and we've got most improved to talk on.
Oh, I think probably the Hornets situation, right, Alex? And man, this is a franchise, sadly, that's just been cursed. And they haven't made a playoff series in 8 years, since 2016, when they lost that close 7-game series to the Miami Heat. And Steve Clifford, we thought, was maybe just hopefully turn the rungs around in Charlotte. He did it when he first got appointed, as when they were called at the time, the Bobcats, back in 2013, and got them into the playoffs the following season. And unfortunately, things never really delve from there. And it's just an interesting one, though, Alex, with the Charlotte franchise and where they go, because there are some good young players there. Of course, LaMelo Ball and his ankle injury situation, and he's been trying, I think he mentioned about this too, LaMelo, about his ankles, and he's been trying to wear sort of heavier ankle braces to help support those number of sprained ankles he's endured, right, for what, 3 seasons he's been in the league for. So that's a real sort of, it's a question mark in a way too for what happens for his health going into the next season. And Miles Bridges, of course, had a bounce back year. And I think one thing too, Alex, Miles Bridges led the league in minutes during the regular season. I think he averaged about 37.5 or something, 37.6, which is, yeah, quite remarkable. So that's one there. And he had, again, had a bounce back season. But it's just, they have to find someone with experience. It's simple as that, I think, for this whole Charlotte team, because I think there's a bit of a rebuild that they're going to have to go through and try. And of course, with Brandon Miller, the pick two from last year, and he had a very good rookie campaign. So they've got something to build there with those big three. Yes, Miles Bridges is 26. Brandon Miller's what, 20, 21, if not mistaken? I think 20, if I'm not mistaken. And LaMelo Ball's 21, 20. So or 23, should I say. So they've got something there, but it's those other pieces that they have to sort of build. And I thought they would have gone for Jody Fernandez. I think that would have been another option too, as we spoke about last week, Alex, his credentials and, of course, him being hired as the Brooklyn Nets coach. I think he would have been a very good fit with the young core and sort of demand this accountability, which Charlotte on the defensive end have just been so porous for many years, sadly. So, well, we'll just have to see, right, with the whole coaching hiring. So hopefully it's a good one, though. Hopefully someone like a similar to a Paul Silas when he led Charlotte to a few playoff appearances back in the early 2000s.
And just not like his son, who was the coach of the Houston Rockets for a couple of years, and we don't talk about him anymore. Julian, you can talk about JJ, the Spurs and Trae Young, or the Most Improved Award.
I think with the Most Improved Award, it was a winner that people probably don't have any arguments over, but really it comes down to that debate of if a player is already good, should they get the Most Improved Award? Kobe White, which is your pick, actually had more total votes than Maxey, but Maxey had more first place votes. But in terms of, like, if you want to go just purely off numbers, I mean, Maxey went up 5 points from last season. He went up 3 assists, whereas Kobe White went up, well, obviously this is due to his minutes going up as well, but he went from 9 points to 19 points per game. He went from 2.9 rebounds to 4.5, and he went from 2.8 assists to 5.1. So you could make a case for him as well. But no, I don't think anyone's got any issues with Maxey, given that he's sort of adapted into that point guard role with the absence of James Harden. So no, I'm very happy for Maxey, but definitely could have made a case for Kobe White as well.
Tom, your choice from the three selections as well.
I just have to talk about JJ Redick. I want to know, does he keep the podcast if he was to get a coaching job? I mean, Draymond Green's got his and he's playing. What does the podcast look like when you're a head coach of a team that's like 6-25?
Hey, I'll tell you what it looks like. They draft Bronny James late in the second round. LeBron signs as a free agent to Charlotte. Let's go, baby! X's and O's on the podcast for everybody.
But honestly, I will promise you guys this right now. If LeBron James goes to Charlotte and is able to do anything with that franchise, I will 100% say that he is the GOAT over Jordan, because Jordan couldn't do anything.
That's an excellent point. That's a very excellent point. Okay, performance of the week. We're getting off the rails. Jules, we'll start with you.
I'm going to go with Pascal Siakam. He had 37 points, 11 rebounds, and I think he had 6 assists and a team that had 38 total assists, which I'm pretty sure is a record in the playoffs. The highest this series of playoffs between all the games was 27 total assists. So 38 just blew that out of the park. So yeah, Pascal Siakam for me.
Yuri, you had an Oklahoma City Thunder player.
SGA's 28 points in that decisive game one. And of course, we already talked about his big 3-point play there. And I still think, though, the Pelicans did a very good job on SGA throughout the game. Even though he shot 11 of 24, which is still super efficient, he shot 46% overall, but he was 0-3 from downtown, but of course he doesn't take too many threes. So it's just interesting, though, with what we've already spoken about, the Pelicans and their whole assignments on trying to just stop his mid-range jumpers and deny him those couple of dribbles. So will we see more double teams, though, from the Pels? That's probably the big question that comes into mind from the early outset for game two, and try and make him just not take those easy strides in to mid-range, and hopefully I'll probably curtail. And for how long? Well, we'll see, hey?
Tom, performance of the week.
Yeah, I went with Jaden McDaniels today. 25 points, 8 rebounds, 3 assists, 10 of 17 from the field, plus 24, and just a lead D. Like, he's so good. I mean, I flagged it last week who he would guard. He's doing a tremendous job on Durant. Today, they try and get him off and switches, and it just doesn't matter. I think he could potentially be their sort of X factor throughout this playoffs. And I completely forgot he missed the series against the Nuggets last year. They mentioned it today on the broadcast, and it just kind of clicked and went, maybe, I'm not saying he would have made a difference, but he might have made that a bit of a tighter series. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do throughout the rest of this playoffs.
I had two performances of the week. We just touched on one. It was JJ Redick from his fifth podcast to a head coaching interview. So well done, JJ. And then Mike Breen, the New York native, on the call, national media, on his home team, the best bang we've ever heard. It was a double bang. You don't hear many of those. And the moment suited it. So shout out Mike Breen. Maybe I'll play it again here in post. That is it for today's episode of the NBA Recap Show. Obviously, if you're still here, you like basketball. I'm telling you, make some time this week in Australia to watch these series. Most of them have been really fun. We're due in the Cavs Magic series too, so maybe you watch that one. They're due for a good game. We don't know if next week's episode will be at the regular time. I'm up in Cairns running the North Queensland game, so we'll find some time, I guess, to make the show work. But hopefully we've had a series wrap up. It might be the Lakers Nuggets, by the way, things are going. And we can talk about the second round and what's coming up. I've been Alexander J. That's Yuri Bilsich. That's Julian Balthazar. In my bottom court is Tom Dev. I'm going to make him give the outro for today's show. Go ahead, Tom, take us home.
Please leave a 5-star review wherever you get this podcast. We want to climb those rankings.
Where's the energy? Come on.
Look, I'm like Anthony Davis at the end of the press conference. You know, Jamal Murray hit a shot. I'll just drop the mic and walk off. And then, you know, it's the end of the podcast. Like, mic drop. It's like, see you all later.
That's a pass. All right. See you guys next week. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, guys.
Cheers, Alex.
Thanks, guys.